Instincts honed in 100 battles before his accident, Harold sensed real danger now, and spun with his hands clenched for a fight. Standing in the ruined doorway was a hugely overweight woman, dressed in frilly clothes and holding a long blaster. Not a homemade model like the bouncer in the hall, but a proper shotgun. She worked the pump and pointed the muzzle not at him, but straight toward Laura. Harold moved between them to protect the girl.
Smart move, Sarge. But this is loaded with bent nails and glass, boy. Cut you open like a fish.
Harold pointed at the bound girl.
Mine!
The gaudy house madam shook her head, never taking her eyes off the hunchback giant.
No, Harold. Laura is mine. Her father sold her to me. I own her.
Harold lowered his head and took a step forward. Instantly, the madam triggered the blaster, blowing a hole in the plasterboard wall the size of a sewer grating. He stopped the advance as she worked the pump action again, but didn't relax.
Mine!
Harold's deadly hands were still extended. The madam was armed, but if the shotgun didn't kill him on the spot, he'd rip her head off before dying.
Sergeant O'Malley, listen to me. By the law of the Ville, this was a legal transaction. The Baron himself is a client here and encourages whoring. It's a service to the Ville. We forge treaties between families. Immigrants don't get raped anymore. It's a good thing. Sluts are special people. The Ville needs sluts.
Gonna marry her! Father said okay. Called me son. She mine. Mine.
Interesting.
Now the madam felt more in control. His tone was softening, and she was starting to understand. So old man Arnstein had sold his daughter cheap, knowing the Ville hunchback was in love with her. That's why nobody else wanted the girl, in spite of her incredible beauty. Well, she'd settle the score with the old cheat later. Right now, she had a brain-dead Hercules who wanted to walk off with her prize slut. No way Pat was going to let that happen, at least not without making a profit. Maybe the Sarge could be of use to her in certain matters. Debts to be collected, break a few legs. She might have him under her control for years.
Well, that's too bad about her father, Sarge. I paid for her fair and square. Canned food and shoes. A good knife and two blankets without holes.
Harold wasn't sure of what to do. Things that had to be moved or broken, invaders or muties to kill, these he could fathom. Real things you could touch. This was beyond him, and the voices were beginning to whisper terrible bloody suggestions.
Me bye.
Tucking the shotgun under her arm, Madame Patrika laughed heartily, making her whole body jiggle.
Oh, my poor young fool. You weren't shoveling boiled crap in the greenhouses. You could never steal enough vegetables to pay for a beauty like this.
Behind her, the bouncer reappeared, the tiny blaster in his grip, a savage expression on his face. Harold looked directly at the man, the way he did with the desert wolves, and the man went pale, backing into the corridor. Suddenly remembering the package in his back pocket, Harold removed it.
Got this!
He tossed the bundle to the woman. It landed on the floor between them. Wary of a trick, Patrika moved aside and told the bouncer to get the package. Opening it carefully, the madam almost dropped the shotgun in shock. Inside was a Predark hand blaster, a Smith & Wesson 357 Magnum in perfect condition, the barrel shining with oil, as smooth as winter ice. Even the cushioned grip was intact, without a single crack or tiny piece missing. Unfamiliar with the blaster, she fumbled a bit before managing to release the cylinder and check the barrel. Perfect. The damn thing might as well be brand new. She dry-fired it a few times to check the spring, the solid sound of the hammer falling, music to her ears. Shutting the cylinder with fingertip pressure, Patrika stared at Harold, who was standing as if braced for a whipping. He was fully capable of tearing this whole house down to the foundation, and now he stood in fear of her words. Did he know what this actually was? And what it was truly worth?
And in bullets!
Harold showed a fistful of cartridges, fearing her lack of response was an indication the blaster wasn't good enough. It was the best he could find. He was supposed to give it to her father as dowry, but was it enough to buy his wife free from the bed? Without fear, Patrika walked closer and took the bullets from his trembling palm.
This is forbidden. None but the Baron and his men can own blasters.
But the madam took them and tucked them into the fold of her dress. With a blaster like this, a person could risk leaving the Ville, be free of the bastard machine forever. Anybody could leave the Ville, but outside there were many muties and animals that waited for Norms to risk crossing the desert. Not many ever came back. A working blaster in this condition could have bought him the whole damn gaudy house for a week. 10 times enough to buy a retarded slut who had to be tied to the bed to keep her from rolling over and offering the wrong end to a customer.
Enough? We go now?
Patrika lied with a straight face.
No, this doesn't buy her, boy. A lovely thing like Laura can earn more than this each moon for years. The Baron himself wants her, and who can risk angering him?
Choking slightly on her gag, Laura shivered on the bed, and Harold gently reached down to lay a blanket over her partially nude form. She smiled around the rag at him and closed her eyes, drifting off to sleep.
Buy me a month, no kissing?
Kissing. How sweet, the poor dullard.
No, Harold, everyone must work. No work, no food.
An animal growl started low in the man's throat, and the madam realized she had gone too far.
But it will buy you a week off her back, if that's what you mean. She can scrub pots in the kitchen and clean the labs, mop the floors.
The voices in Harold's head screamed for a better deal.
2 weeks.
Patrika was surprised he would even try to bargain. Maybe he wasn't as insane as she had heard.
1. Plus, I don't tell the Baron you found a blaster. In the Ville?
Harold shrugged noncommittally. Damn, he wasn't talking.
However, if you want to marry her, it will cost a lot more than this one poor blaster.
She pressed her thumb against the hammer and pulled the trigger a few times.
See? It's no good. Broken already.
The man frowned, contorting his face into a grimace.
Have long blasters. Bagful.
He spoke slowly, testing each word as if they were rotting timbers on a bridge. 1 wrong move, and he would fall to his death.
A duffel bag?
A glum nod.
That enough?
In the hallway, the bouncer sharply whistled.
Yes, dear Harold, that's enough. Come back in a week with a bag full of working blasters and Laura is your wife. Working blasters, mind you, not junk like this.
He nodded again.
And ammo, of course. Blasters are useless without ammo.
She smiled as sweetly as possible.
That sounds fair, doesn't it, Sarge?
A minute passed, then 2. The only sounds were of labored breathing from the customer bleeding on the floor, and the muffled noise of sex from down the corridor. Finally, Harold agreed.
Ammo. All I can.
Your word of honor?
My word of honor.
The momentary transition to sanity frightened the madam worse than his growling. This was a dangerously unstable individual.
Done.
Patrika offered her plump hand for a shake.
In 1 week, you deliver a duffel bag of working rifles and ammo, and she's yours forever.
With a massive effort of will, Harold tried to concentrate enough to recall how many days were in a week.
6 days. Back 6 day.
He brushed past her, ignoring the offered hand and moving down the hallway as indomitable as an express train. Once he was gone, the bouncer tucked his zip gun into his belt.
What a freak!
Patrika grabbed the man by the arm.
You heard nothing! Not a fucking thing, or I'll whip you to death myself!
And risk the machine? Bullshit. I want a cut.
Impressed, she released him.
One blaster.
Five.
Two.
Done.
They shook on the deal. With a soft groan, the customer on the floor stirred and struggled to sit upright. His nose was mashed flat, and the lower half of his face was clotted with dried blood.
Gonna kill that mutie. I got an axe. That'll do him.
Surprisingly quick, Patrika walked over and grabbed the man between the legs. He gasped as she squeezed hard.
Touch him before the next moon and I'll remove these with blunt scissors.
Nearly wetting himself, the man nodded emphatically. She released him and smiled seductively.
Still got one coming.
Patrika loosened the frilly top of her dress and pulled it down to expose her fat, sagging breasts. She pinched the nipples, making the wrinkled bags of flesh harden.
Come on. I'll do you right here.
Yanking up his clothing, the man backed out of the room.
I'll come back later. Gotta get a healer to fix my nose. Later.
As he dashed away, Patrika stepped into the hall and hoisted up her skirts, showing that she wasn't wearing anything underneath.
I'll be waiting for you, lover!
Gagging and pale, the man scurried down the stairs.
He won't be coming back. But I'll do you, honey.
On Tuesday as usual, not before, Jimmy.
Fair enough. But, what about the girl?
Jimmy jerked a dirty thumb at the sleeping form. Her lips pursed in thought. Patrika slowly walked over and slapped the girl. Laura awoke with a start, struggling against the ropes.
Just throw a bucket of water over to cut the smell. And tell the boys downstairs, the line forms to the left.
In the kitchen of the redoubt, Mildred, J.B., and Doc were assisting with the preparation of dinner for the group. It was their turn, and having ovens at their command was making the usually odious task easy. Especially since, while the redoubt may have been out of food, the life support system still functioned, and everybody had luxuriated in a hot shower. After three jumps in one day, the group needed a good scrubbing to get out the sour stink of sweat. They each took turns while somebody else stood guard in the hallway. It was a basic survival plan that all members of the group were never unarmed at the same time. Sneaking a glance at J.B., busy working at the table, Mildred remembered being joined in the shower, and they had used the rare privacy to make love. Privacy was hard to come by these days. Unfortunately, the sex had really put an edge on her appetite. Scrubbed and shaved, they happily found that the laundry worked fine, if somewhat noisily, and donned clean clothes afterward. As well, many of the officers' quarters hadn't been completely cleaned out, and they located replacement boots for her, a fresh shirt for Dean, and underwear for everybody. Reaching inside her denim shirt, Mildred shifted the strap on her U.S. Army-issue bra. It wasn't a perfect fit, but a hell of a lot more comfortable than the old Air Force one, which had been one cup size too small. Rooting about in the cabinets, Mildred had made a lucky find of a few staples lost amid the petrified breakfast cereals and dust-filled plastic wrappers of granola bars, tea, honey, and rice, items that didn't go bad with age if kept away from dampness. Keep rice dry, and it lasted forever. Not a lot of nourishment, but it would bulk up their meager meal of beans. The group needed fresh food supplies quick, or else they really would be reduced to eating their leather goods. After which she didn't care to think about. Lowering the heat of an electric grill under a small saucepan, Mildred placed the open jar of honey on a folded cloth lying at the bottom of the softly boiling water.
Can't believe that stuff is still good after 100 years.
The table nearest the stove was covered with full water pitchers, napkins, disposable plates, and cups for the evening meal. Spread out before the armorer at the next table over were several pairs of army boots, and he was meticulously removing the laces from one to insert in another. His own battered boots were lying on the floor, the soles worn paper-thin in spots, the leather badly cracked. His feet were wrapped in brand-new woolen socks taken from the base PX. He wiggled his toes at the sensation, savoring the feeling. Mildred lifted the lid on a pot full of rice and stirred the contents with a long fork.
Honey doesn't ever go bad. Over a few years, honey crystallizes as solid as rock, but low heat will melt it again. I caught on TV once how honey from Egyptian times had been recovered and found to be edible, and that was a hell of a lot longer than the big blow.
Doc sat patiently before the chugging dishwasher.
Hot tea with honey for dessert. What a delightful treat. What kind is it, madam? Orange Pekoe?
U.S. Army issue foodstuff. Classification, tea for drinking.
Doc's face fell.
Oh. Still, better than not.
Sorry there aren't any scones.
She added some water to the stew. The delicious smell was a knife in her belly, and the physician had to restrain herself from tasting it constantly. At least with the rice, they would all be able to eat their fill.
Ah, scones and jelly. How I miss that.
Bananas. Hurts to think I might never have another banana.
J.B., finishing the first boot and starting on the next, overheard the conversation.
Vids. Back in Alaska, we found a redoubt once with a working vid player and a ton of vids.
Ooh, Denzel Washington.
Mildred stole a glance at J.B. and winked. He returned it with emphasis.
Jeremy Brett. The superlative thespian, compounded by the fact that we look so similar.
Even if you sound more like John Carradine.
Who?
The dishwasher musically chimed and stopped working.
Ah, at last.
Opening the door, he moved aside to avoid the outpouring of steam. Using his handkerchief with a blue swallow design, he retrieved his Lama from the drying rack and laid it on the table to cool.
Never seen anybody clean a blaster that way. That'd wreck my Uzi.
Doc carefully replaced the wooden handle on the bare metal frame of the hand cannon.
Dissolve the nylon bushings, yes. But I recall reading how Jeb Stuart used to boil his once a week to clean away the oily residue, while General George S. Patton soaked his in whiskey.
Would have thought that would be Ulysses S. Grant.
General Grant waste whiskey on a gun?
I stand corrected.
Mildred wiped her hands on a dish towel.
So it's good for the Lamette?
Doc juggled the hot blaster from hand to hand.
Mandatory! Absolutely mandatory! I sealed the loading holes with grease to prevent a cross-firing. The old girl needs to be scrubbed every now and then, or else the works clog.
Scowling, J.B. opened his mouth to speak, then shut it. Doc was never going to upgrade to a decent blaster, and that was the end of the matter. Mildred turned down the heat and drained the excess water from the rice.
Well, dinner is done.
She poured it into a huge ceramic bowl, steam rising from the crumbling mound.
Start serving, Professor Tanner.
My pleasure, madam.
With a flourish, Doc slid his empty weapon back into its holster. Clean as a whistle, it was still much too warm to load. That would have to wait till later.
I'll call the others.
J.B. tied off the laces and went to the intercom on the wall.
Dean and Jack are still in the garage patching the Hummer together?
Last I heard.
Mildred lounged in a chair. Her part of the meal was over. Doc would serve and J.B. would wash up.
So Ryan and Christy are...
They both smiled.
Where else?
Taking another seat, Doc barked a laugh, and then apologized for the rude behavior. Smiling himself, J.B. glanced at the digital clock on the wall.
Well, okay then. We'll give them another couple of minutes.
The underground redoubt was designed to support 100 soldiers and command staff, so there were plenty of private showers for the officers and spacious group showers for the troops. Ryan and Christy had investigated the commander's private bathroom, but the stall was too small for a couple, so they moved to one of the main showers in the barracks. Clean, warm water cascaded steadily from the 16 showerheads onto the naked couple as Ryan soaped Christy's back in long, steady motions. The suds trickled down, covering her perfect buttocks like the finest lace. Christy purred as his hands moved over her shoulders, more massaging than scrubbing, then swept lightly forward to brush the outside of her breasts.
Feels wonderful.
The redhead glanced backward and smiled. Ryan's eyes told her what she wanted to hear.
You better be serious.
Always. Ryan stepped closer to slide his hands over her slippery form to cuff her full breasts. He could feel her nipples instantly harden, and the woman arched her back, thrusting her buttocks firmly against him. He stiffened in response, but didn't move. And for a brief period of time, they stayed that way, allowing the warm water to flow freely over them, easing away the rigors of the past week, savoring the moment of privacy and peace. Dinner will be ready soon.
Then shut up.
Christy turned and kissed him full on the mouth. She ran her hands down his muscular torso. Breathing deeply, Ryan crushed Christy to his chest, her full breasts spreading warmth across him that quickly spread to his groin. In spite of being damp from the water, her long red hair moved wildly about, forming a fiery corona around them as it responded to her excited emotional state. They kissed again, deeply, tongues and hands traveling everywhere. As Ryan cupped her buttocks and squeezed, Christy wrapped one leg around his waist, and then the other. The man shifted position to accommodate her weight as she hoisted herself upward, and he slid deep inside her, the heat of their joining overwhelming the warmth of the shower. She cried out softly in pleasure, digging her nails into his muscles. Vividly, Ryan remembered how he had wanted the voluptuous redhead the first moment he had seen her, and it seemed like the most logical thing in the world for them to have sex. But both were surprised when the casual fornication changed along the way, and instead they found themselves making love that night. No words were needed or spoken as they gently rocked back and forth, feeling the excitement build until neither could stand anymore. Holding her tight, Ryan carefully eased to his knees and then laid the woman on the army blanket covering the tiled floor. He started to climb on top, but Christy forced him over on his back instead, her velvet thighs straddling his muscular waist, rubbing deliciously over him, rough and smooth at the same time. Her magnificent breasts dangling in his face, Ryan licked a nipple and nipped the other. Raking her nails down his chest, Christy moaned in passion and arched her pelvis. They both inhaled sharply as he slid deep into her once more. She rose and fell in curving motions, the soft flesh engulfing him as her unique internal muscles caressed the man in ways no other living woman could. His hands gripped her waist hard as the gentle tempo became quicker, more urgent. She met his fervor, and thoughts of foreplay ceased, the sounds masked by the falling waters of the military shower. Softly in the background, the intercom chimed, and JB's voice announced dinner was ready, but neither noticed nor cared. And for a few precious seconds, the two lovers enjoyed their private celebration of life and love, giving no thoughts at all to combat or death. The winged mutie watched the opening of the cave from the air above, waiting impatiently for the food to reemerge. Her belly crawled with hunger as her metabolism raced to heal the holes in her wings caused by the barking sticks of the two legs. Fury welled within at the remembrance, and she cut loose a scream of rage at the meat escaping so easily. However, the mutie knew better than to try for them in the terrible light, the most fleeting glance making her blind and helpless as if she were prey. Soon the Skyfire would return, forcing her into hiding once more, and the prey would be safe to leave and travel away from the hunting ground. The thought was intolerable. There were young to feed. Then instincts flared and the rage slowly calmed. Eventually the meat would be forced to come out, and she would gather them in the coming night before they could reach the terrible beams of light. Darkness was her mantle of safety. Fluttering her great wings, the mutie took flight and circled above the cave one last time, before turning her attention to the smaller creatures of the desert. Lizard eggs would do for now, but she could already taste the fresh blood, and imagined it running down her fangs and chest. Soon enough, she would return, and feast upon their living flesh. The black cloud slowly became tinted with hints of orange and gray with the coming of dawn, as Harold darted from the shadows and moved to the outer wall of the ville. The hunchback looked both ways for the Sekhmen on patrol, but his timing was good. They were beyond the curve of the circular wall, and the buildings blocked their view of this area, but only for a moment. The second team would be here soon. Taking a battered brass key from a pocket of his dirty clothes, Harold unlocked the smashed trunk of a big luxury car and stepped inside. Crouching low, he closed the lid tight, pulling until hearing the click that told him the lock was engaged. After waiting a few minutes to become adjusted to the darkness, Harold pushed down the back seat, wiggled into the front, clambered over the dashboard and out the gap where the windshield used to be. Crumpled cars and wags surrounded him on every side, tireless wheels jutting out, sprinklings of greenish glass squares everywhere, and seatbelts dangling from above. From outside, the wall appeared to be impenetrable, a solidly compacted mass of smashed metal, but the hunchback knew that was false. The old Baron had designed this area himself, and after the workers were finished, Harold had done something to them that made his head hurt to remember. And sometimes he woke from fevered nightmares of screaming men begging for life. Able to see somewhat better now, Harold wiggled forward between an array of tires and tailpipes, ducking under a transmission and into an explosion hole in the side of a military APC. Climbing up the sloped interior, he left by the escape hatch in the roof, slid across the armor, and climbed down the undercarriage of a slanted school bus. A rat scurried from the wreckage, and Harold stomped it flat, then moved on. Nasty things. Folks got sick and sometimes died when they got bitten. The old Baron and the new both had a reward on the rats. Kill 100 and get a day off from work. Nowadays it was getting hard to find 100. The rats wouldn't come into the villa anymore, which made Harold sad. The first gift he had ever given Laura was a box of 100 dead rats. That was the first day she kissed him, and he knew they were in love. Carefully sliding through the split top of an armored bank truck, Harold maneuvered up the wall shelves and into the front seats. Unlocking the passenger side door, he swung out and dropped the full yard to the concrete apron outside the ville. Directly before him was the dead river, the stink of sulfur hurting his nose and eyes. On the other side of the stained concrete banks were the ruins of the pre-dark city. Holding his breath, Harold listened for any movement on the wall above. But the world was still asleep. Not even the stingwings of the lizards were up and moving yet. However, the clouds seemed more yellowish than normal, and panic seized the man as he wondered if the deadly acid rain was coming early this year. But in spite of his proximity to the polluted river, the smell in the morning air was wrong, not strong enough. He gratefully relaxed his powerful shoulders. No storm was forthcoming, and it would be safe for him to leave the ville and do what had to be done to save his poor wife. Closely following the rusted wrecks composing the wall, Harold watched the searchlights crisscross the brightening sky. Dawn was when the night crew went home to sleep, and the day crew turned off the colossal lights and did maintenance on the alcohol-driven generators, transformers, and jennies. Shivering slightly from a damp chill in the air, Harold waited until the beams winked out. Moving fast, he dashed forward a dozen yards and dropped to the rough ground. Prying off the grate of a storm drain with his bare hands, Harold scrambled inside and eased the 100 pounds of rusty iron gently back into place. He was halfway there. With a smooth hydraulic hiss, the black metal door to the redoubt moved aside, and the sputtering Hummer rolled through the opening, bluish smoke coughing from the muffler. At the steering wheel, Ryan gave it some gas and worked the choke until the engine smoothed somewhat.
You sure the timing is right?
Ryan studied the gauges on the dashboard. Plenty of fuel, and the battery was charged, oil pressure and water temp at acceptable levels.
Sounds like bad piston rings.
JB stood in the cargo area, an arm resting on the long M60 machine rifle attached to an upright gimbal, a linked belt of ammo traveling from its breech to a big box attached to the stand. There was another sputtering cough, and a small explosion of blue smoke.
Is this going to make it to the ruins?
With Ryan doing the driving, Christy was the point guard for the journey.
Be a long walk back.
Doc looked at Ryan from his perch on top of a stack of weapons crates.
Especially, sir, conveying the rest of us on your back.
The Hummer was much larger than a military-style jeep, but not quite of sufficient size to comfortably hold 7 people and a load of supplies. Doc had lost the coin toss, and so was resigned to the cargo area, with the water barrel and bazookas. A folded towel offered his bony hindquarters some comfort, but not much. Jack sat in the back seat, jammed between Dean and Mildred, with boxes of supplies at their feet.
Be okay. Just old.
The engine is just burning off the excess oil buildup. JB and I flushed it twice, but there's always a bit left over.
The engine suddenly smoothed into a powerful hum.
See? Told ya.
Huh. Better.
Ryan gunned the gas a few times to check the response. The big Detroit engine obeyed promptly, so the Deathlands Warrior put the Hummer into gear and started following the tunnel to the exit. Christy bobbed her head about to see where they were going. The damn snorkel for the power plant was next to a window, partially blocking her view. But they hadn't been able to get the thing to retract, so she was stuck. At least it was only the air intake and wasn't blowing exhaust into the wag. The snorkel was designed to automatically cut in if the vehicle went into water deeper than a few feet. Jeeps were faster, and APCs offered serious protection, but for general work, Christy thought the Hummer was damn near perfect. It did everything well, even if the only armor it had was in the floorboards to protect the crew from landmines. The doors were only stretched canvas and wouldn't stop a newborn stingwing. A faint grayish light was emanating from the distant opening to the outside world, giving enough illumination for driving, but Ryan hit the headlights just the same. The brilliant halogen bulbs flashed on, filling the tunnel with blinding white light, almost painful to see. Mildred blocked her face with a raised hand.
That should blind the mutie if it returned in the night. Damn near blinds me as it is.
Jack, an albino, said nothing, and simply slid on a pair of old, cracked sunglasses. JB jacked the big arming bolt on the M60.
Well, if it did come back, this will chew it to bits.
But watch for the brass. He spits them fast and far.
Too bad that 50 cal from storage wouldn't fit. That'd chill any mutie.
JB ducked under a roof support beam.
And most war wags.
And flip over the vehicle. Not even a Hummer can support a 50 cal in full fire.
35. I mean nukes chill ants.
Mildred sat uncomfortably on top of a field surgery kit.
John, be sure to aim for the center. The wings are only membrane with no real circulatory system.
Like shooting fish in a barrel.
No, son. Only a fool aims for the fish. You shoot the barrel, it can't dodge.
Just spend the brass and save your ass, because I don't want to have to use this.
The physician patted the belted canvas lump between her boots with affection. It was the find of her life, and one that she had been searching for since she awoke in this century. A field surgery kit. A real, honest-to-God, fully equipped U.S. Army MASH medical kit. Mildred had found the incredible treasure in the first aid station, which had the only locked room in the redoubt. Probably to keep the troops out of the brandy and drugs in the supply cabinet. And as Mildred wasn't registered with the redoubt's mainframe as the doctor on duty, the palm lock had refused her admittance. But a crowbar convinced the door to open for her anyway. Neatly jammed with surgical instruments specifically designed for soldiers in combat, the pack was as heavy as hell, but the physician couldn't have been more pleased. Dr. Mildred Wyeth was a trained doctor, but without instruments, there wasn't much she could do for serious injuries. The external light got brighter, and the companions prepped their weapons. Ryan slowed the Hummer to a crawl, but as they rounded a turn, they found the outside ledge completely empty. Only a few of their spent brass from the previous night on the rocky ground. Breaking to a halt, Ryan killed the engine to save fuel. The companions disembarked, with JB staying at the machine gun to give them cover if necessary. Warily stepping outside, the friends found the tunnel ended at the top of a gently sloping hillock that flowed downward into a vast expanse of sandy desert, low dunes rising and falling across the barren vista like waves on a calm sea. In the far distance, completely dominating the horizon, were the sprawling ruins of the huge pre-dark city.
Spread out and look for the mutie. 5 yards, one-on-one.
A breeze wafted over them from the desert, carrying the smell of heat and dust. Instinctively, he checked the rad counter on his shirt collar and was relieved to see the background count was normal. This wasn't a hot area. Dean squinted at the overcast sky.
Not circling above us. But it sure looks like a storm is on the way.
Those are the wrong type of formations for rain. They more closely resemble dust clouds.
Jack frowned, scratching his cheek with the muzzle of his .357 Magnum.
Huh. Nukes.
The tinted lenses of the sunglasses made the teenager seem even paler than usual.
Or a camstorm.
Ryan kneeled on the ground and studied the soil for tracks or prints.
No spore, or bones from a kill.
Quite right. We seem to be alone, O Captain, my Captain. Our uninvited guest has sought lodgings elsewhere.
Christy moved away from the tunnel to check above them.
Unless it has a nest on another ledge.
The tunnel opened near the base of a large outcropping, a mesa, actually. The main column of the granite mountain had shattered into splinters and boulders from some terrible geological event.
But with all this light, I don't think the night feeder will be out and about to bother us much. Mother Gaia, protect us!
Blasters at the ready, the others quickly joined the redhead and stared in wonderment. Where huge sections of the mesa were gone, smooth sections of a dull black material could be plainly seen in the shadowy light. The material wasn't marred or scratched in any way.
That's the exterior of the redoubt. This whole area must have been underground before the war.
Then it became desert and the winds unearthed the redoubt. Now we know where that odd tunnel came from. Somebody saw the base and was trying to gain access.
Ryan shook his head.
No. That tunnel was built by Old Tech. Those beams were ferroconcrete. They can't be made anymore.
The sound of a starting engine shattered the early morning quiet. The companions dropped into combat positions, with Deem crouching to fire his new blaster from a kneeling position for greater stability. A moment later, their Hummer bounced into view with JB behind the wheel.
Everything okay? You were taking too long. Dark night! The outside of the redoubt!
No other ledges or caves along this side of the mesa. Maybe the muti came from the ruins.
Sure seems a lot bigger than it did last night.
Deem cradled the long blaster in his arms, but made sure the muzzle wasn't pointed at anybody. He had caught hell for accidentally doing that once, and he'd never repeat the mistake.
Seems like the buildings reach for miles.
The darkness had to have masked the true size of the pre-dark city. The outlying structures stretched in every direction, and there were rows of tall buildings downtown, some slashed on a diagonal cut from erosion, or with jagged tops from fires. But one marble edifice towered above the others, a single shining skyscraper, untouched by the ravages of time or war. Doc rested both hands on his cane, the silver lion's head peeking out between his laced fingers.
Gulliver in Lilliput.
Not Chicago, Miami, or Big D.
Not any place I know, either. Anybody else?
Ryan eased the safety on his blaster before holstering the weapon. There was a negative chorus. Mildred craned her neck for a better view.
And no sign of people that I can see.
We couldn't spot a wag at this range.
JB retrieved a spyglass from a cushioned pouch on his belt. He extended the brass scope to its full length and closed an eye to look through it.
Well?
JB collapsed the tube.
Still too far. We need binocs to see details at this range.
Might be deserted, then.
No, not deserted. Somebody was operating the searchlights. And much as I hate killing, I sure hope they have a lot of enemies. We'll get a better price with folks who have a fight coming.
Everybody has enemies. We'll do fine with this lot of blasters and rockets.
Blasters always good. Heard about man bought life by giving Baron can opener.
Really?
Believe it.
Deem touched the Swiss Army knife in his pocket. Was it that valuable? Ryan climbed back into the Hummer and started the engine, which revved up on the first try.
You ever try to open a can of stew with just a knife or a rock?
JB displayed a finger.
Yeah, and I still have the scar.
As the rest jammed into their seats, straddling boxes and crates, Ryan studied the slope of the hillock. Off to their west was a flat section of desert, a nice long stretch of hard-packed sand. Maybe an ancient highway or a dried riverbed.
We'll head for that natural road. Should make good time.
Christy wrapped the strap of the styra around her forearm so it couldn't be dropped.
Others might have the same idea. Best be ready for an ambush.
Gotcha.
JB straightened a kink in the ammo belt of the M60.
Stay sharp, folks.
An ambush? From whom? A tumbleweed, perhaps?
Ryan shifted gears and released the handbrake.
No, she's right. Those searchlights can be seen for miles. Could have every cold-heart bastard, junker, and nomad from the whole countryside down there.
Wherever down there is.
The city was vaguely familiar to Mildred, but that was all. Nothing specific. Then again, most big cities resembled each other. Who could tell Toronto from Seattle if their major landmarks were gone?
We'll find out when the stars appear tonight. That cloud cover's gonna break soon. I can smell it.
We used to sled down a hill like this, all covered with snow and twinkling with ice. My wife would have hot chocolate waiting for the children and me when we came home afterward. Cold. It was so cold in Vermont that winter.
Doc's voice faded away, and he stared into the distance, reliving another life in another world. Ryan dropped into low gear and started down the slope.
Hold on tight!
The grade was steep, but the Hummer dug in, and he began zigzagging to control their speed. However, they were still going faster than he liked when the Hummer bounced over a hidden gully. The companions cursed, and the supplies jumped about wildly, but none left the wag.
Warn us next time, will you?
JB clung to the M60 with both arms, the ammo box jingling with every jolt. Mildred handed him back his dropped fedora, and he stuffed it on. Ryan dodged another gully, then a cactus.
You want to drive instead?
Sure, pass me the wheel.
At the bottom of the slope, the Hummer dipped into a ravine and rolled up gracefully onto flatland. Ryan gunned the engine and started in the direction of the crude road they had spotted from the hill. Keeping a grip on the M60, JB looked around, studying the horizon for any suspicious movements.
The landscape is bare for miles. At least nobody can sneak up on us until we reach the city.
Mildred altered her grip on the medkit. A shopping list of supplies was already forming in her mind.
And if the locals won't trade, there must be some stores to loot.
Yeah, maybe some canned goods that haven't gone bad.
In this heat? Not likely. Maybe some homemade preserves in a glass jar, but nothing in a tin can.
Sweeping the vented barrel of the M60 from side to side, JB shrugged.
Hell, anything is possible. Just look at the place.
Indeed. It could be a veritable cornucopia, a bacchanalian trove of treasure.
Everybody hung on as the Hummer rolled up an incline and came to rest on the path. The dried sand had cracked into a crazy jigsaw pattern. Dunes rose on either side, offering some protection from the warming desert winds. But they all realized that if this were dawn, by noon the city would be an inferno. The miles went by in steady progression, the three-hour-plus trip to the ruins uneventful. A cooling breeze blew into the military wag from their speed, but also a contrail of dust rose from the Hummer-studded tires on the loose sand. Any hope of sneaking into the ruins was now completely gone. Spotting a moving shadow on the sand, Jack intently watched a stingwing cruise through the murky sky. The bird sailed off toward the east, as if the ancient city ahead of them held no interest to the little mutie. That was a good indication. Stingwings feared nothing and ate everything. Perhaps the ruins were deserted. As the Hummer approached the outskirts of the ruins, the buildings rapidly rose above the horizon. Oddly, there seemed to be no houses or stores to show the gradual expansion of the metropolis. The structures simply jutted from the sun-baked soil, like fence posts with windows. Most of the windows were a dull white in color. Mildred wiped the sweat off her face with a moist towelette.
Desert storms sandblasted them white.
Nobody contradicted her theory. An octagonal sheet of metal on a post heralded their entrance into the nameless city, and Ryan immediately slowed the progress of the Hummer. The streets were completely bare. Not a car, a truck, or even a piece of a vehicle was in sight.
Strange. No cars, yet the buildings are intact.
Another neutron bomb?
Seems that way. No bodies, property undamaged. Only, where are the vehicles?
Maybe the survivors drove away.
Could be, but if the city was hit by a nuke, the engines would have been deactivated by the EMP blast. And if it was a chem storm or germ warfare, then all the people would be dead, but the car's okay.
So somebody took them afterward.
The Hummer rolled past a parking garage. The gates were smashed, and every level they could see into was vacant. Ryan didn't like where the conversation was going.
Yeah, maybe. But what would you need 1,000, maybe 10,000 damned cars for?
Wall? JB rested his finger on the trigger of the M60.
Makes sense. We've seen it done before. Just not on this scale.
They rolled past a new car showroom, The windows gone, the sales floor deserted.
But it's got to be one huge build to need every car.
The ruins seemed to be thinning ahead of them, so Ryan took a left at an intersection heading toward the skyscraper. Soon, bits and pieces of broken asphalt started to show under the sand covering the road, and within a block, they were driving on cracked pavement. It was a rare experience.
Stay sharp.
Ryan slowed their speed to get a better view of the ruins. Large, snowy windows fronted the street on each side, the same down every side street. Above stores, empty metal frames swung in the soft breeze, the plastic long ago eroded, and the tattered remains of a movie theater marquee seemed bullet-riddled with the hundreds of empty light bulb sockets. Street signs of different shapes stood wordless on shiny metal poles, every trace of paint completely removed. Ryan brought the Hummer to a halt.
No rust. Must get a lot of acid rain here.
That stops rust from forming?
Washes it off. Sandstorms and acid rain. Not a good area to try farming.
Doc glanced around carefully.
Storm damage is minimal. Mayhap the buildings themselves act as a sort of windbreak.
I'd have thought they'd funnel the wind and worsen the damage.
Close.
Ryan drove around a huge pothole in the middle of an intersection.
Faster wind means less sand to form piles.
JB removed his hat to wipe his forehead with a sleeve. Even with the unbroken cloud cover, it was still getting too damn warm. He replaced the fedora with a pat.
I'm surprised that muty was around. Wonder what it eats.
Lizards, I'll bet.
Christy watched a fat lizard with a twitching spider in its mouth dart out from underneath the mailbox and scuttle away into a sewer grating at their approach. The lizard's claws churned the sand and left a little contrail of dust to mark its passage.
Lots of them around.
And what do they eat?
Bugs, worms, old shoes, leather couches, mink stoles, anything. After sharks, reptiles are the only true omnivores.
The desert is an ocean with its life underground and a perfect disguise above.
Past a corner, the squat buildings became neat rows of apartments and strip malls. A yellow sheet of newspaper blew by the wag, the faded headlines touting vital information from a century ago.
This place gives me the creeps. Got the damnedest feeling we're being watched.
Studying the white windows on the buildings, Jack nervously clicked back the hammer of the python and eased it down again with his thumb.
Yeah, me too. Eerie.
Holding the stire, Christy said nothing, but her hair was coiled tightly in response to her disturbed frame of mind.
Thought it was just me.
One important question kept repeating itself over and over in Ryan's mind. Why hadn't a pre-dark city this large and in excellent condition been looted yet? Suddenly, he had the strangest urge to turn the wag and head straight back to the redoubt, when Dean pointed something out.
Hey! Look there!
Visible over the rooftops of the two-story apartment complexes was a pair of curved metal arches.
Must be bridges.
Ryan shifted gears and headed in that direction. There had been no evidence of the searchlights or the owners in this section of town. Perhaps they were across the river. It made sense to stay near running water in a desert. Then, a strong whiff of sulfur made the men wonder if they were heading toward an acid rain lake. As the Hummer took a corner, a dockyard spread before them in crumbling majesty. Rows upon rows of long warehouses lined the concrete apron of the shore. Deep recesses, clearly designed for dry docking vessels, notched the embankment, with tall derricks standing alongside for ferrying cargo. An opening dropped away from the dockside, some kind of a storm drain or river. But more importantly, across the span was a jumbled wall of smashed cars and trucks, towering 30 feet high, and extending in both directions to curve out of sight. Ryan parked the Hummer a safe distance from the docks.
Looks like we found the source of the searchlights.
The concrete looked solid, but the 5 tons of the Hummer might send them all plummeting into whatever was at the bottom of the smelly trench. Best to take no chances.
They raided this side to fix the other. Smart folks.
Architectural cannibals. How unique.
Removing his glasses, JB extracted his folding telescope and extended it to its full length. With great care, he scanned the other side.
Nobody in sight.
Killing the purring engine, Ryan nodded and climbed out of the wag.
I'll take point. JB, you're on guard.
JB folded up the telescope and slid his glasses back on. He patted the breech of the M60.
Check. Any trouble and I'll sound the alarm.
Spreading out so they didn't offer any snipers a nice clustered target, the companions proceeded closer to the edge of the concrete. The smell was worse here, the reason soon painfully obvious. 100 feet down was a sluggish yellow river, reeking of sulfur and other chems.
Must be runoff water from the desert. We already knew they got bad acid rain here.
Mildred clutched her med kit.
Now how the hell do we get across this?
Don't.
Jack jerked a thumb to their left. Nearby, the great arches of steel were all that remained of the pre-dark bridge crossing the river. A wide road led to paved ramp extensions that ended in melted gobbets of cooled metal only feet from the embankments. An identical section stood on the other side of the river, but the center span of the bridge was completely gone. Worse, two more smashed bridges were visible upriver, hundreds of severed steel cables dangling limply into the brackish flow of the polluted river.
Well, if we dive in, the fall wouldn't hurt us. But nobody could live for long in that water. Plus, there's no way to climb up the other side. Those support pillions are thicker than the Hummer.
Maybe after they took the cars, the people smashed the bridges.
And permanently cut themselves off from all the material on this side?
Doubtful. Ryan rubbed his jaw in thought.
I think if we follow the shoreline for long enough, we'll find how they get across.
Maybe fly like muties.
Resting the long blaster on her shoulder, Christy merely arched a fiery eyebrow at the unsettling suggestion when a piercing scream of terror sounded from their left, followed closely by the telltale rattle of autofire.
That was a child!
Ryan agreed, and friend or foe, combat was always something that should be investigated. The next minute, it might very well be coming their way. He drew his pistol and started forward at an easy run.
Silent probe, single yard spread.
Clutching a headless doll, a small girl was running madly down the sandy street, her long hair flying in the wind. She slowed to glance over her shoulder to see if the monsters were still after them. Her father was screaming at her.
Keep running!
He dropped to one knee and discharged a hand blaster at the pack of wolves chasing them. The weapon banged in smoke and sparks, and a store window down the street exploded into pieces. Cursing the inaccuracy of his blaster, the man turned and ran, trying to reload, but paper and lead balls dropped from his fumbling hands. His wife ran without pausing, a small, crying bundle held tight in her arms. Straight ahead, the road angled into the ground and ended at a tiled wall with two huge openings. The left side was crudely bricked solid, ivy growing up the stones to show the age of the work, but the right side was open. Two large wooden doors swung aside, exposing a brick-lined tunnel extending into the darkness. Two gigantic machines of some sort bracketed the tiled wall and formed an impressive barricade. In front was a sandbag wall topped with twisted coils of barbed wire. Behind the sandbags were two men in pre-dark uniforms, the first in military fatigues, the other dressed as a policeman. They were frantically working Nimrods to charge their muzzle-loading rifles. The policeman was notching a barbed arrow into a crossbow made from the spring leaves of a car. He screamed, taking aim at the family with his weapon.
Here! This way! Keep coming!
The military man, a private, locked back the hammer on his museum piece rifle. He leveled the rifle and fired. The long blaster thundered like a bazooka, volumes of smoke exploding from the barrel, almost hiding him.
Don't look back!
But no yelp of pain came from the snarling animals so very close behind the runners. Turning, the father fired again, and the lead wolf yipped in pain. Shoving his blaster into a pocket, the elderly man then ran for all he was worth, losing items from pockets at every step of the way. Almost losing the doll in her arms, the girl reached the wall of sandbags and stopped, looking for a way past the obstruction. The policeman reached out to grab her arm and brutally hauled the child over. She gasped in pain and landed sprawling on the side, losing her toy. The private scooped it up and thrust it back into her tiny arms as he shoved her toward the opening in the tiled wall.
Run to the end of the tunnel! Go! Don't stop!
Pausing for a moment, the child glanced at her folks and then took to her heels into the darkness beyond. The mother made it next, the sleeve of her thin shirt ripping off as it brushed the barbed wire coils. The private boldly leaped out to gently assist her and the crying baby over the sandbags while the policeman fired the crossbow. The arrow appeared to go straight for the father, but it missed him and kept on going. A wolf howled as the man sprinted forward. The private escorted the woman inside while the policeman stood between her and the oncoming wolves. Coolly raising his weapon, he cocked the hammer and fired, thunder and smoke vomiting from the crude rifle. Diving over the sandbags, the father landed hard, but rolled over and came up with a machete in his hand. The policeman knocked that aside.
We have blasters! Inside! They won't get past us! Save your family, man!
Sheathing the blade, the father nodded in thanks and dashed into the darkness. Instantly, the guards relaxed their tense posture and, smirking in satisfaction, lowered their weapons. Then they shared a grin, ran inside, firing their blasters into the air.
The wolves are here!
The policemen started to walk casually toward the wooden doors, lighting a cig and blowing a smoke ring.
Stand firm! Don't let them pass! Hurry, hurry! Get the axes!
Reaching the barricade, the wolves stopped and milled about, looked expectantly at the men. The lead wolf started to wag his tail in anticipation. Smiling widely, the policeman tossed the pack something from his pockets, which the animals happily devoured, and then dashed off into the ruins, barking and yipping. Retreating a few blocks, the companions convened behind a garbage bin before allowing themselves to speak.
Fire blast! Did you see that?
Leaning wearily against a brick wall, Christy nodded.
Ugh, a sham. It was all a sham.
Phew.
Long blast is firing. Not one wolf hike.
And no dust kicking up from the misses either. It's a new sham on me. I thought I'd seen them all.
Bastards! Utter contemptible bastards! Ugh!
Dean stared at the junkyard wall across the river. No sounds could be heard from this distance. Even blaster fire would become lost in the wind, so anything could be happening out of sight behind the imposing barrier.
What do you think they do with the people?
I don't know, son. Slaves, maybe.
Returning to the Hummer, they informed J.B. of the situation. As he sat on the wag's bumper, the armorer contemplated.
Sounds like blanks. Shit-eating sick men were firing blanks. You sure about all this?
Makes sense. Searchlights draw in folks to investigate. Then, somewhere along the way, a pack of pet wolves attack, herding the people into the vill. The sick men pretend to fight them off, and the victims rush inside for protection, while actually thanking their captors.
Deuced clever way to increase your population. Highly contemptible, but I must admit that I am impressed by its sheer audacity.
Dean held his new rifle, his eyes never pausing as they searched the shadowy ruins for possible enemies.
So, what about that winged thing we found in the cave? Think that's another sheepdog?
No, its head was too small. No way it was as smart as a wolf.
I'd guess that was for real, or possibly the stick to the carrot. If anybody tries to escape, it'll be at night, and the bird, or whatever it is, attacks them.
Why doesn't it attack the vill, then?
Weak eyes, I assume. Those searchlights would keep the mutie far away.
Well, mutie aside, you all seem to have missed the most important point.
J.B. adjusted his glasses until he had their full attention. Then he smiled broadly while chucking the bolt on the Uzi.
We now know where dinner is coming from.
All of their faces brightened in understanding. Dean felt a rush of adrenaline.
Is a wolf hard to kill?
He wanted to do something for the poor trapped folks, and if he couldn't free them somehow, then chilling the wolves was the next best thing.
Most pack animals are. Just have to catch one off by itself away from the others. And once we ace the wolves, tomorrow it'll be much easier to cut a deal with the Baron of the Vill without getting caught between two enemies. He'll keep expecting the wolves to show. That'll keep them off balance and give us an extra bargaining edge.
And if we can't find them?
Standing, J.B. went over to pat the long, ventilated barrel of the M60.
Then we'll just have to reason with their Baron the old-fashioned way.
Jack brushed back his snowy hair.
Went north. Wind gonna muddle tracks. Go now.
Ryan climbed into the Hummer and started the engine.
Agreed. We'll circle around and approach from the west, so the guards at the tunnel won't hear us.
Taking their seats amid the cargo, Ryan kept the Hummer in low gear to be as quiet as possible. As they drove along the zigzagging maze of streets, until finally reaching the park just west of the great skyscraper.
Thank Gaia for that building. Without street signs or maps, it'd be easy to get lost in here. But just check the angle of the sun and you have a location.
Like a sundial.
Dean chewed over the notion.
Pretty smart.
Christy smiled.
Your father taught me that.
Jack leaned way out of the wag, studying the ground.
Stop.
Shifting into neutral, Ryan eased to a fast halt, and Jack hopped out, walking back a few yards to bend low to the ground and brush his fingertips across the smooth sand. To Dean, there didn't appear to be any marks on the sand, but Jack stood and pointed down an alleyway decisively.
8, 6.
JB estimated the opening.
Damn alley is too small for the Hummer. Want to circle around again?
Too close.
Jack frowned.
Here, and run.
And we don't want to go chasing them all over the ruins. There are far too many places they can reach that we can't.
On foot, then. Christy, stay with the Hummer. We'll follow the six.
If you come back running, I'll be ready.
She handed the Steyr to him.
The M60 might reduce dinner to hamburger instead of steaks, but at least it'll be us on the outside digesting them instead of the other way around.
Ryan bent close to exchange a fast kiss, then checked the long blaster and ammo belt. Satisfied, he started across the street.
Full weapons, everybody, and stay close. Packs fear other packs.
With Jack in the lead, the companions eased into the alleyway, following the trail of faint depressions in the loose sand. The next street down came into sight, but the two companions conferred and took a side alley. Coming out a block to the east, Jack raised a hand and then closed it into a fist. The group froze and got ready for combat. Just a block away was a smashed store window, the only gap in the endless seam of white store windows that lined the street. Spreading out, the companions eased toward the gaping hole, Dean and Mildred watching the windows above for any signs of snipers. It could be another trap, and better safe than dead. Above the smashed window, words were chiseled into the marble lintel of the building, but time and the winds had worn the engraving down to vague, unreadable squiggles. But recently, somebody had neatly painted the huge single word across the stone lintel.
Supir Marcut. Not only thieves and liars, but illiterates as well.
Mildred scowled in agreement while Ryan studied the crude sign. Yet another damned trick for travelers in the city. Solos or explorers looking to loot would find this open food store and naturally go inside to check for canned goods. That's when the wolves charged, and the victims would get herded straight to the vill like sheep. Jagged daggers of glass jutted like teeth, ringing the opening. From their vantage point on the sidewalk, they could see bare floors inside, a bank of linked carts to the left, registers to the right, and rows upon rows of shelves stretching out of sight. A fine sprinkling of sand lay over top everything for yards, and the rear of the store was masked in darkness. Signaling for silence, Ryan tapped his eye and gestured at the store. Rifle in one hand, he drew his Sig Sauer and knelt on the sidewalk, listening for any sounds of movement inside. The ghostly moan of the desert wind whispering down the street was discernible, but nothing else. No dripping pipes, no ticking clocks, not a snarl or a cough. Extracting a small plastic mirror, JB eased it past the jamb of the window and tilted it inward to scan the area.
Behind the registers.
Eagerly, Dean started forward, but Ryan stopped him with a single raised finger. The boy retreated, and the elder Carter first pointed at Jack, then Doc. Keeping his blind left side to the wall, Ryan poked the muzzle of his Steyr around the jamb, just as JB did the same on the other side with the Uzi. The lead wolf was large and heavily muscled, with brindle markings showing it was from the forest lands. The rest were smaller and leaner, similar to whippets, but none seemed to be starving, and that was a bad sign. Hungry animals would just attack, and any organized group of defenders could easily withstand them. However, a well-fed pack would wait and watch until a mistake was made, then charge when its victims weren't paying attention.
Wait for it.
Then, with a roar, the Hummer bounded into view, a barking pack of wolves surrounding the vehicle. Driving with one hand, Christy was firing at the leaping animals with a blaster gripped in a bloody fist, while Doc fired his Lamar into the store.
Behind us!
Ryan spun and there were the other six wolves crawling around the registers, moving as silently as ghosts. In a heartbeat, the hunters had become the hunted. Dean cut loose with the G-12. The blaster hissed a stuttering zip of caseless rounds, and six of the eight animals were torn into pieces under the incredible fusillade of subsonic steel. But then the HK stopped, and the youth realized he was out of ammo. Dropping the spent weapon, he drew his hand blaster. Ryan discharged the Steyr, and a wolf in the store flipped over, crashing into an ancient display rack. Free from the attentions of the beasts for a moment, Christie scrambled into the back of the Hummer and cut loose with the M60, the weapon chattering a deadly hellstorm at the beasts. Two danced in the air as their bodies were torn to pieces before the rest spread out, running wildly in every direction, one even darting under the vehicle. But there was method to the madness, and Ryan cursed as he realized the wolves were combining into a pack again. The running around was merely intended to disorient the humans before a unified charge.
Move to the wall!
He dropped the empty Steyr and drew his Panga while firing the Sig Sauer.
Get the leader!
But as if they knew what those words meant, the animals stopped running and crouched in fear, their haunches rising in submission. But then, the wolves' eyes glazed over, and on each of them, a third eye blossomed wide, the yellowish orb glaring with monstrous hatred.
They're muties!
The foreheads of the wolf pack had split open to display their third eye with a large square pupil like a goat's. Then they charged, moving across the sandy street with nightmarish speed. Christie got in one more shot, and JB burped the Uzi twice in short controlled bursts, chilling one wolf and wounding another, before the animals swarmed over them from every direction. Kicking at the slavering muties, the companions fired non-stop, wounding the animals over and over, but not one dropped. Snarling and snapping, the animals took wild bites, but only got layers of cloth. They spat the material out in disgust. Christie fired the M60 one final time, then was forced to stop, her hands helpless on the trigger of the deadly machine gun. Without a clear view, she could chill her own people instead. Slamming in a fresh clip, Ryan shot the leader in the leg, and as it closed upon him, he kicked the wolf in the jaw, his steel-toed army boot crunching bone. Spitting teeth, the animal backed away, drooling blood. Sidestepping a charge by two wolves working together, Dean punched one in the face with his empty blaster and buried his knife into the other one's muscular shoulders. Jack quickly fired his booming magnum pistol twice, nicking a darting wolf. Then his blaster clicked on a spent shell. He was out of ammo, and there was no chance in hell of reloading it.
Goddamn.
Sputtering a virulent curse, the albino teen dropped the blaster, and two knives appeared in his pale hands. With a flip, one was reversed, with the flat of the blade resting along the bone of his forearm, and the teenager went into a knife fighter's attack crouch. A wolf flew past him, and he slit the beast's belly open as it went by. Spilling out its writhing guts, the wolf trembled and fell over, its long legs starting to paw the sand as if it were still charging. Incredibly, it started to rise again, so JB discharged his shotgun directly into the hole where the third eye had been. Its head blew apart into shredded bones and blood, and the animal dropped. Darting and dodging, the wolves bit more cloth, the rips now exposing vulnerable flesh. Steady as a rock, Doc stood amid the yipping muties and calmly fired a seventh, eighth, and ninth time, his huge .44 caliber Lamah booming hot lead death. The booms shook the walls of the store, and blood sprayed out from the hip of the wolf. But the animal neither slowed nor stopped from the glancing blow. Her back against the wall, Medkit laying protectively at her feet, Mildred banged away carefully with her ZKR 551 target pistol, finally wounding one animal in the shoulder, blood forming a geyser from the severed femoral artery. The wolf staggered from the wound, and Ryan rammed the stock of his Steyr into its face, bursting apart the third eye. Pus and wiggling filaments gushed from the cranial wound, and the wolf froze, motionless from the pain. Ramming his 9mm blaster into its ear, Ryan fired, and brains sprayed out the other side of its head. The corpse stiffly toppled over to the bloody sand. Dean charged a wolf, shoving his Browning blaster into its misshapen face. He yanked the trigger as the wolf dodged. The bullet missed, but the muzzle blast seared the unblinking third eye, and the wolf retreated, howling in agony.
Get out of the way!
A wild honking noise announced the violent arrival of the Hummer, As Christie slammed the military wag against the brick wall alongside the companions, the headlights shattering as she crushed a wolf into pulp. Now, safely bracketed in a corner, the companions concentrated their weapons on the animals, blowing away chunks of flesh with every round. The alpha wolf recoiled as half its head was torn away, and two smaller muties alongside it crumpled from the impact of the hollow point rounds. Another pair of muties was slammed to the ground, blood gushing from hideous wounds. The last mutie dashed madly about between the moving human legs, zigzagging wildly as it sought escape. Blasters fired and knives stabbed, but missed. Desperate, it leaped onto the hood of the Hummer. Christie burped the M60, but the 38 hollow point rounds only grazed its body, removing wads of meaty fur. Diving among the humans, it bounced off the side of Dean, ducked between Ryan's legs, and broke free from the group, sprinting for freedom. But it suddenly stopped, with a full yard of shining steel thrust through its laboring chest. Doc twisted the blade of his sword, enlarging the wound, and dark blood gushed under the sidewalk. Whimpering in agony, the mutie struggled to get away, its goat eye rolling backward into its head until only the yellow showed. Bracing a boot on the writhing beast, Doc yanked the blade free and thrust it back in again and again, skewering the chest, the stomach, the throat, searching for the vulnerable heart. Still trying to crawl away, the beast emptied its bowels as its whole body violently shuddered and went abruptly still.